From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I almost felt like I was in this sort of apocalyptic movie where it's like, no, you can't throw us in District 9. You know, it's like, it was weird.
As a Muslim stand-up comedian, Daily Show contributor Hasan Minhaj found that he could relate to political reporters when he agreed to the daunting challenge of doing the first White House Correspondents' Dinner of the Trump administration. Minhaj tells us about crafting his routine in just 3 weeks and the far slower process of creating his new and very personal Netflix special, Homecoming King. But first on the News Banter, a shocking plot twist for the young Han Solo movie. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by a new co-banterer, Richard Rushfield, editor-in-chief of The Ankler, a new daily newsletter about Hollywood. He's sitting in for the vacationing, very rare, but he is vacationing, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. And Richard, we have a very full news week to talk about.
It was supposed to be a slow, quiet week for us.
Yeah, the summer. Nobody got that memo, especially not Lucasfilm. I mean, Lucasfilm just shook Hollywood with the seemingly sudden, I don't think it was sudden to them, firing of Phil Lord and Chris Miller, the two directors who were well into shooting the as-yet-untitled young Han Solo movie. And Phil Lord and Chris Miller are very well-established guys in Hollywood. They did the Lego movie, 21 Jump Street. They're not like these young directors that are picked up after a small success. They're known people with a fan base of their own. And all I can say is things must have been absolutely horrific on that set, and distress must have run very deep for Lucasfilm to do something so absolutely extraordinary as to fire directors in the middle of, well, beyond the middle of production.
It is amazing. I mean, firings like this on movies this size just don't happen. They had problems on the last one, on Rogue One, with Gareth Edwards, but that was sort of quietly handled without a publicly announced.
Yes, Gareth Edwards was a good boy, and he sort of sat onto the side. And
sat on the bench, yeah.
They let the screenwriter, Tony Gilroy, step in. And that was an open secret in Hollywood. But in this case, clearly there was a huge difference in vision, and Lord and Miller were not willing to go quietly.
Well, Kathy Kennedy, the head of Lucasfilm, has a long storied history of working with the great directors of Hollywood, the sort of lions of Hollywood.
Notably Steven Spielberg, yeah.
And Steven Spielberg and David Fincher and others at the top of her career. And I've heard that she is not exactly warm and fuzzy with young auteurs putting their own vision and fooling around on her zillion-dollar projects there. And that seems to have been a problem with Lord and Miller from the very beginning.
Yeah, Lord and Miller, you know, they're used to a more improvisational style. I mean, on the Lego movie, you can kind of toss out lines and the actors can read them and it doesn't make a huge deal. But with Star Wars, you're dealing with a script by Lawrence Kasdan, and he is the keeper of this true Star Wars flame. I can only imagine how unhappy he must have been, because I'm assuming he was a big part of saying, this is not okay. They are not shooting what our vision of this is, the vision as I wrote it, and I want it to be delivered by these actors.
You know, Marvel had this practice in its early years as they were getting started of they would bring in these young, flashy auteurs to direct their films who would basically be sort of figureheads to steer the ship, this giant ship, through the production and maybe be allowed to put a little flourishes here, a little quip or two. But basically, they would take the ship where Marvel wanted. And it seems like Kathy Kennedy had a similar vision for that, but perhaps Lord and Miller were not willing to be mere figureheads in this.
And in fairness to Lucasfilm, the value of this property, I don't even know what you would quantify what it means. It's probably the most valuable intellectual property I can think of off the top of my head. And therefore, protecting this, that is her job. And she had to do it. But I could just say, wow, this is going to go on and on with the Directors Guild trying to figure out who gets a credit, with the press focused laser-like, fans laser-like, what did Ron Howard, who has now been named to direct this thing, do? It's hard for a guy to even find a director who would come in these circumstances, because, you know, there is a feeling that you are stepping on someone who has been stepped on. And Ron Howard goes back years with everybody who goes back years in Hollywood. So I guess he felt that he could do this.
I think this whole debacle really takes a bloom off the Lucasfilm rose that has had such a halo around it since it's its Disney incarnation. And the release of this film is now just going to have this shadow over it. And every question is going to be about how much of the Lord Miller version survived, how much was Ron Howard changing it, how much was Lawrence Kasdan getting in. There's going to be this fanboy legend that will go on for eternity about what the Lord Miller version would have been. And as far as I know, the DGA could decide that they get to keep the credit on it. Ron Howard might not be the credited director in the end of all this.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes. I mean, I will say that the way they did salvage Rogue One, as you mentioned, which was by all accounts such a mess, I'm willing to wait and see. But yes, nonetheless, whatever happens, this upset will reverberate going forward. And that's the way it is. And I will now talk about the other gigantic upset that's underway. Apple has hired Zach Van Amberg and Jamie Ehrlich. These are two executives who ran Sony Television. Sony Television being an independent studio, not so easy to make it work in this landscape where all of these channels are owned by big producing companies that and they want to own their own shows. Sony doesn't really have a channel of its own. It's been one of its handicaps. Nonetheless, these two guys, known around town as Zach and Jamie, invariably have shows including The Blacklist on NBC, The Goldbergs on ABC. They had Breaking Bad and They Better Call Saul and The Crown on Netflix. Pretty impressive. And there was a tough negotiation with Sony. There's a new boss at Sony, Tony Vinciquerra, and these two guys went out the door and really, I mean, you want to talk about a big announcement right immediately on the heels of it. Apple hired them, and that means, you know what that means, Richard?
That means Apple is getting into the game alongside Netflix and Amazon and Hulu. And it had the feeling of sort of the studios were in this battle with the streaming services and kind of losing but holding their own, still on the field and giving up. And then they look up on the hill and see there's this army standing there that's bigger than all the armies they're fighting combined, about to come down and sweep them off.
Yeah, I mean, that has got to be really scary for people, because how is this all is going to work, I don't know. A lot of people thought Apple would buy Netflix or something, you know, and establish itself that way. And they may still, right? But either way, when you hire these two executives, it does say, you know, we came to play.
I mean, they might buy Netflix, but they don't even need to now.
Right. They have systems in place.
Yeah. Netflix 5 years ago was Hemlock Grove. And now look what they have. And they're doing that by spending $6 billion a year. $6 billion a year to Apple is an accounting error. They can spend many times that on creating the biggest studio the world has ever seen if they feel like it.
And imagine how they can package things together. I mean, it's the talent under that roof right now. You know, they'd made some tentative steps in this direction. They had some app competition show and somebody trying to get some kind of car karaoke thing going. That just looks like, you know, the beginnings of something that is now swept aside by something much bigger. So that will be one of the stories, actually, I think, of the year.
Absolutely. This could be the beginning of the end for, or the end of the end for the studio production process.
Yes, things will change. Thank you, Richard.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Richard Rushfield, editor-in-chief of The Ankler.
We're joined now by senior political analyst Hasan Minhaj, everybody.
Hasan Minhaj is best known as a correspondent on The Daily Show, but the 31-year-old comedian has been branching out. In April, he took on hosting duties for the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the first one under the Trump administration, and the first one in more than 30 years that was held without the president in attendance. Ronald Reagan was the last one to miss it, but he'd been shot. Not long after Minhaj delivered a well-reviewed roast in absentia, his new special, Homecoming King, dropped on Netflix. In it, he tells the story of growing up as an Indian-American Muslim kid in Davis, California. Watching that show, I noticed that when Minhaj said his own name, especially when he was voicing a dialogue with one of his parents, he didn't always say Hasan Minhaj. So I started out by asking him, as one does when hosting a radio show, how exactly do you pronounce your name?
If you're from the South Asian subcontinent, my name is Hasan Minhaj. You know, that's the way people say my name. But there's a lot of people that have the name H-A-S-A-N that live in, you know, North America or Western Europe, and it's pronounced Hasan. So both are totally fine.
The attempt to navigate the worlds of Hassan and Hassan is one of the themes that runs throughout Minaj's Netflix special. Another is his parents' constant refrain when he was growing up, Lo Kya Kenge, or what will people think? This question arose yet again when Minaj was preparing to introduce his Muslim father to his fiancée's Hindu family.
He goes, Hassan, I don't think we should do this. Lo Kya Kenge, bhai? What will people think? And I don't know if you guys know this, but every time a brown father says Lo Kya Kenge, a star actually falls from the sky. Do you know? Mom, Dad, I don't want to be a doctor. Are Lo Kya Kenge? No. I don't want to marry so-and-so. Are Lo Kya Kenge? Why? I bet you when Mahatma Gandhi told his parents he was going to stand up to the British and liberate India, even they were like, Are Mohandas Lo Kya Kenge, bhai? Stop marching, eat something. The British are going to talk shit about us.
Homecoming King is not a straight-up comedy set, but a blend of comedy and storytelling. Minaj says crafting its complex structure took time.
It was almost like a three-year process of developing the show, workshopping it with my director, Greg Wallach, and then taking it to the Sundance Labs, developing it even more, and then coming out, moving to New York, joining The Daily Show, doing it off-Broadway and touring it. So all in all, it was about 3 years putting it all together.
So you were doing that before you were doing The Daily Show?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
The Sundance Labs, how does that work? I don't know that aspect of Sundance Labs.
It's kind of like art summer camp. You go to the mountains and you're paired with advisors. My advisor was Sarah Treem. I was at the New Frontier Lab. So that was sort of this lab that was cultivated in storytelling and new mediums. And because my show had interactive elements, it was sort of pushing and expanding upon the traditional quote-unquote stand-up comedy experience or special. And so that's basically what you get to do there. And then you get to sit in a cabin with Sarah and she'll give you notes and, hey, why don't you try this? And you're there for a whole week. And it's almost like when you leave summer camp, you're pen pals with everybody. And you continue to check in and work. It's really awesome. I wish you got to do that on a lot of projects. That's why I love the lab so much, and I love what Michelle Satter is doing out there.
So you apply and you say, at this point, you're not a known. You're like the Pizza Hut commercial.
No.
Was it the Pizza
I'm
Hut?
I'm the Pizza Hut guy.
Yeah, you had a commercial, and you're like, yeah. I want to tell the story of my youth in America.
Yes. I want to tell the story of New Brown America.
So you are using material, even at that stage, I'm sure, that is drawn from your life, from your family, and from your schoolmates. And I'm assuming that some of this is the real deal. So did you feel that you had to go back to your parents, to your siblings? You talk a lot about your younger sister.
Yeah.
To the ex that you talk about in the show. I don't want to give away too much about the show because it's great, but you talk about an ex-girlfriend.
Yeah.
Did you feel like, I got to reach out because I'm using all of this?
Yeah. I reached out to, you know, all three of those parties. My parents, my sister, and the Bethany Reed character in the show. And, you know, I talk about it in the show, that moment where I go meet Bethany at that cafe in New York, where 10 years later, I sort of confront her about all the things that I went through with in regards to my race and identity and the things that I sort of struggled with from high school going forward. I kind of had to do that also with my parents and my sister. And what's really interesting about storytelling is it's wild. You know, with my parents, a lot of times, they were like, I had no idea you went through that, obviously because you hid it from us.
Right.
And I was like, well, you guys hid a lot of things from me too. Immigrants sure do love secrets.
Yeah. Parents love secrets, honestly.
Parents, they love sort of just, and then unleashing them on you later.
Yeah, they wait for that perfect moment.
And then they're like, yeah, go unpack that. And you're like, what? Oh my God. But what was interesting is when talking to about it with my sister, her vantage point, and I wish there was almost like a Homecoming King too. I'm speaking from my perspective. For her, she was just like, oh my God, you are so melodramatic, which is so funny to me. Like, she's like, you are such a drama queen. Like, she's so, oh my God, what is your problem? But I think that's really interesting. And there is always, with narrative storytelling, that's why I've always found movies and TV shows interesting, where you see the same event through the lens of two very different characters.
A little Rashomon thing going on there.
Yeah.
So you have all this time to do this show. You go through workshops and the Sundance Lab and all of this. And yet I read somewhere that when you were taping the show, your parents came, but it sounded as though they had no familiarity with this material as performed by you.
Yeah. So I made sure during the taping, you know, with the stage directors and the people that worked at the house, hey, make sure I can't see them. The last thing I want to do is perform and look out and see my mom, dad, and sister.
I'm amazed you didn't just say, could you not come?
You know? Well, what's wild is it was a big thing in the town that I grew up in.
Like, oh, right. You did it. You wanted to do it in Davis specifically.
Yeah, the guy from The Daily Show is coming back and he's going to be talking about a lot of stories. You know, at this point, they had sort of heard like, oh, he's got this show off Broadway, but, you know, a lot of people don't know. And so the reason why I chose to do it there in Davis is because I wanted to capture that energy too. Mm. Hey, I'm going to be talking about race and identity and all of these things, love, forgiveness, in a city that is otherwise considered to be a liberal bastion. And I wanted local people that live in the town. And you can kind of hear that and feel that in the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
There's big pockets of silence or sort of groans or like
uneasy laughter. Yeah.
Uneasiness. And I wanted that to be in this. I didn't want to do it at the Beacon or, you know, some other venue that would be great. But I wanted it to capture that. That's what I wanted to do in the special. So I made sure that my parents weren't sitting far away. But after show one, my sister comes backstage and I was like, oh, my God. Like, my mom and dad were following her. And I go, Aisha, like, what did they think? And Aisha goes, so I was watching mom and dad watch you, but mom and dad, they weren't watching you. They were watching the audience. And then when the audience would laugh, they would sort of have this sigh of relief of like, oh, it's okay. Everybody goes through this.
Right. What is it? What will people think?
What will people think? Yeah, my parents were having Lokya Kenge. What will people think in real time? They were like, what will the audience think? Oh, they think it's okay? Okay, got it.
It's okay then. Okay. But you still wanted them there, which I even having that in your head, I would just feel like so weird if in trying to do that with my parents.
I really, you know, despite the messaging of the show and everything I went through growing up, I am who I am because of them, not in spite of them. It really is my love letter to them and the sacrifices they've made.
But they did not have any inkling of the material, or they did? No.
They had seen, you know, articles here and there, you know, interviews. But to see it in its entirety, no, they were not fully aware. There are certain things that it's like, yeah, I hadn't talked about that story with my dad until he saw it, like the September 12th night. That's something we never talked about.
Mm.
You know, the night that like a hate crime happened at our house.
My dad's in the middle of the road, sweeping glass out of the road like he works at like a hate crime barbershop. Just like, oh man, we got customers, Lokya Kenge, we gotta clean this up. Zen, brown Mr. Miyagi, just like not saying a word. I run up to him like, Dad, why aren't you saying something? He looks at me and he goes, Hassan, these things happen and these things will continue to happen. That's the price we pay for being here. And that's when I was like, oh no, we really are from two different generations.
It's just something we never mentioned. And then for him to see it on this stage in front of an auditorium of 1,800 people was kind of a lot.
But he was okay.
He was okay.
Coming up after a short break, comedian Hassan Minhaj tells us about preparing for a very out-of-the-ordinary White House Correspondents' Dinner in only 3 weeks. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to comedian Hassan Minhaj, correspondent on The Daily Show, star of the new Netflix special Homecoming King, and host of the most recent White House Correspondents' Dinner. This year, the president said he would not attend the dinner, and a month out from the event, there was still no host. That night, Minhaj explained how that happened.
I would say it is an honor to be here, but that would be an alternative fact. It is not. No one wanted to do this. So, of course, it lands in the hands of an immigrant. It's how it always goes down. No one wanted this gig. No one.
The president always gets lampooned at the dinner, and Trump did not avoid that just by staying away.
We gotta address the elephant that's not in the room. The leader of our country is not here. And that's because he lives in Moscow. It is a very long flight. It'd be hard for Vlad to make it. Vlad can't just make it on a Saturday. It's a Saturday. As for the other guy, I think he's in Pennsylvania because he can't take a joke. Now.
And Minhaj did not save all his barbs for Trump.
Is Steve Bannon here? I do not see Steve Bannon. I do not see Steve Bannon. Not see Steve Bannon. Not see Steve Bannon.
The White House Correspondents' Dinner is a tough gig in the best of circumstances, and Minhaj had a particularly difficult assignment in this odd political year. There's no workshopping that. How do you prep for that?
That's really hard because I got the gig 3 weeks before the dinner. And usually you have about 3 months. But I think it was beneficial, good and bad. It was bad because it was nerve-wracking and I only had 3 weeks. But it was also beneficial in the sense that with the Trump administration, it's such a moving target. Every 24 hours, something changes. So it's one of those things where it was like, even if I had 3 months, I would have had to scrap the set anyways. I look at it as a blessing in disguise.
Right.
But the tough thing was is because there's such this contentious relationship with the administration and the press, and now with the emboldening of the alt-right, there was kind of this target on my back. And I had to basically prepare 25 minutes in 3 weeks, starting at nothing. And I'm very lucky. You know, the Comedy Cellar is like my home in New York. They gave me a lot of protection. They would let me pop in and start working on it. But that first 3, 4, 5 days was really, really hard because I'm starting at minute zero and they're giving me 20, 25 minutes and I'm tanking. And the audience is looking at me like, you're going to host the White House Correspondents' Dinner?
Oh, jeez, that's terrible.
And there was a lot of tabloids and people that were sort of following when the word got out, oh, he's workshopping it in New York. I remember Page Six ran this story, Muslim comedian bombs in New York.
Ooh.
And I was beyond offended, but I was just like, man, give me a break. I've been working on it for 2 days now. Like, cut me some slack. I had to host the White House Correspondents' Dinner, one of the first presidents to boycott the event. Can you bear with me just for a moment? But I was working on it with my head writer, Prashant, and he was like, look, man, this is just a process. We're going to get it right. And, you know, we did like 6 sets a night, and we were just watching the news, and I had so much support from the staff at The Daily Show, too, and we really just sort of focused and locked in. And once we found the narrative theme of, you know, going off after the administration and Trump, but also explaining to journalists the feelings they feel where they're being told they're the enemy of the people, the fact that they have to work twice as good for half the credit. And when one of them messes up, the administration will blame the entire group. Well, now you know what it feels like to be a minority. Once I found that thread, the set really opened up for me. You know, me fighting for freedom of speech and proving that journalists aren't the enemy of the people, that's a bipartisan position. And I thought there was something really powerful of me as an Indian American Muslim kid who, for whatever reason, in this day and age is considered to be the most un-American thing to exist in this country, to fight for the most American thing. I thought that was powerful. And once we cracked that, I knew that it's like, all right, everything else will fall into place.
I got this.
Yeah.
You knew Donald Trump was not coming when you took the gig.
Yes.
I don't know. Would you have felt differently doing it if Trump were there?
You know, I know that people ask me, would you still do the same material? And I'm like, yeah. You know, for the longest time, the general public really thinks that it's an event for the president. Like, it's sort of a dinner. And they don't realize that, no, the WHCA is a group of journalists who cover the White House. They're
that
not
is the
King
White House
Joffrey's
Correspondents'
goons.
Association. I'll just
yeah.
fill in.
When you look out into that crowd and you see April Ryan and all these people that cover the White House, they're not the president's publicist. In fact, they're the people that are trying to keep the administration in check and cover the administration as objectively as possible. So there's that people don't realize. And then number two is that the dinner, they're giving away scholarships to young journalists. It's really amazing. Woodward and Bernstein spoke. Like, it's a really, really incredible night. And so, if anything, him not being there and the boycott that happened and the lack of celebrity at the event, to me, was actually a return to form of what the event really should be.
I don't know who was asked when it was thought that Trump was in and what, you know, how that went down with the White House Correspondents Association, but I'm just wondering if you would have felt like,
I know there were big names that were being thrown around, you know, like James Corden and stuff like that. I really think that it became this hot potato that nobody wanted to touch. But at The Daily Show, it's always in that 9:15 a.m. meeting, we're always thinking about what is the take or underlying position here about this thing that is making people uncomfortable but needs to be talked about. So I felt like I had the training to sort of dig deeper and to say, even though this seems like a quote-unquote PR nightmare, there's something really powerful and important about this. And as soon as I started to dig deeper and learn about what the dinner's about and how it's been going on since 1921 and what the purpose of it is, I was like, oh, no, this is actually a huge blessing in disguise.
Yes, it felt like the right thing. And you had Sam B. I don't know if she had left The Daily Show by the time you got there.
She was there that last year. And then Sam and Jason Jones were sort of transitioning out at that time. But yeah.
We were bookends, right? We were the inside and the outside. So in a way, it was kind of, I was sort of, you know, taping one and watching the other and then watching the one and taping the other. Yeah. And pretty amazing entertainment all around.
And you know what's funny is Sam, I talked to Sam as soon as I got the call. I was like, should I do this? Is this me crossing some sort of picket line? And Sam, she's the best. Sam was like, go for it. She's like, hell yes, you're doing it. And then I called Larry Wilmore, who did it the year before. And Larry said something awesome. He's like, this is awesome. You guys are tag teaming this. There's two ways to protest. You can throw bricks from outside the building or within the building. And now you and Sam are doing both. And that's pretty incredible.
Did you know she was doing her special when you called her?
Yeah, she had announced it months ago. And I totally understood the strategy there. The president is a huge narcissist. And if anything, she wanted to go, hey, look, if George Clooney and Kerry Washington are going to show up to an event, how about they come to mine? You know, that's the one thing you can do to hurt a narcissist.
Yeah, it gave an outlet to people who wouldn't go to the dinner.
Correct.
And then, you know, the room was a little bit simpler in terms of who was present.
Like, when I was in that room that night, it was very tense this year. Because, again, it was all journalists, and the public perception of them, because of the administration, is these people are evil. The mainstream media is the problem, and that's why the American public is misinformed. And so the narrative through the night was, we are not the enemy of the people. I almost felt like I was in this sort of apocalyptic movie, like where it's like, no, like you can't throw us in District 9. Like, you know, like it was weird.
So you were like, I think, Jon Stewart's last hire at The Daily Show.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you know he was going to leave?
I had no idea. I did not know. I had just moved to New York. I was engaged at the time. I was set to get married. And then, like, a few months after I join, he's like, this is my last year. I'm leaving the show. And I'm like, oh, my God. It was just a roller coaster for all of us. But you know what was great? Being around him that last year and having him sort of advise me and push for me in a lot of different ways and really encourage me, it was really great because he really leaned in and gave me and Jessica Williams and everybody on the show, especially us, Jordan Klepper, the young correspondents, he gave us this extra sort of Jedi wisdom, which was really good.
Did you know Trevor Noah?
I did know. You know, Trevor and I were hired the same week. He was hired as a contributor and I was hired as a correspondent.
Oh, I didn't realize that had happened.
So when
I remember seeing him. Yeah.
Yeah, it was almost like we were in the same freshman college class, if that makes sense.
Yes. And so what is it like when that transition happens? Because I got to say, following Jon Stewart it's tough.
It is. It's really tough. And I give Trevor a lot of credit. He dealt with it. Given everything he's gone through in his life, he's very public about, like, you know, hey, you could say whatever you want to say. It means nothing in the face of a kid who's seen apartheid. Like, it's totally, all right, that's fine. You may like me, you may not like me. His perspective on it, he's always been a really cool cucumber, and I've learned that from him. It's really cool. And he's traveled. He travels and he still tours internationally. He asks a lot of questions. And I think that's what makes him really, really special. And the conversations I've had with him are like conversations I've never had with people growing up. I was born and raised here, but it's really, really cool.
Comedian and senior correspondent for The Daily Show, Hassan Minhaj.
Yeah, there
you go. His special Homecoming King is now on Netflix. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Joel Stein. You can subscribe to the podcast as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.